Crisis of an Ayat by Iman Mirsal, translated by Robin Moger. 1. But Paula hadn't gone to the funeral. She didn't know where the grave was. She repeated the story I'd heard from her before, the same details in the same order. That after receiving the phone call, she had gone to Astra Square in Doki, to the apartment there, bounding up the stairs to that second floor. That it had been true what she'd been told. They had broken down the bedroom door searching for her. That she had seen her, stretched out on the bed, beautiful, as though peacefully asleep, the blanket laid over her, smooth and neat. She'd made up her mind and there was no going back, you see. Such determination. She wasn't playing around. Then Paula had lost her mind, swearing at the sleeping woman and beating her hands against the walls. She had left the apartment and hadn't gone to the funeral. At 8 in the morning, 19 February 2015, I commended myself to God and caught a taxi to Basatin. All I had to go on was an address that had run in Al-Ihram back in January 1967. In memory of the late Inayat Al-Zayat, with hearts full of patience and faith, the family is holding a service in her memory, which shall not be forgotten, at the tomb of the late Rashid Pasha in Al-Afifi. Something about these lines itched at me, demanded I edit them, say, the family will hold a memorial service today for she who shall not be forgotten, at the tomb of the late Rashid Pasha, Al-Afifi. Finding this little paragraph among the death notices, I'd been sure that there must be more stories. Among the memories of those still living, say, or in books, or on the shelves of public archives, that all I needed to do was be patient. But now, years after I'd first chanced across this clipping, reverently preserving it as though it were Inayat's identity card, and following the series of telephone conversations with Paula the previous autumn, I still had no idea who Rashid Pasha was, not anything about his relationship to Inayat. I didn't even know his first name. Was he from an Egyptian family? Or Turkish? Was he Circassian? Nothing. One of those 19th century Pashas was my guess. Men who strutted about with their entourages, sauntering through the palaces and vast estates granted them during the reign of Muhammad Ali, and whose legacies were the mausoleums which bear their names. I found 4 men from the period that might fit the bill. The first was a Turkish diplomat by the name of Mustafa Rashid Pasha, born in Istanbul and buried there in 1858. Georgi Zeidan dedicates a chapter to him, in Lives of the Great Men of the Orient in the 19th century. Second was Rashid Pasha al-Kuzlaki, originally from Kyrgyzstan, who was appointed Wali of Baghdad by the Ottoman Sultan in 1853, after leading a military campaign to crush a Kurdish rebellion in northern Mesopotamia, only to be buried in Baghdad just 4 years later, in the Al-Khayzuran Cemetery, behind the dome of Abu Hanifa al-Numan's mausoleum. It was just possible that one of his sons was buried in Al-Afifi. The third Rashid Pasha had an interesting story. A Circassian who spoke Arabic with an accent. He is mentioned in Ilyas al-Ayyubi's history of Khedive Ismail's military expedition against the Ethiopian Empire. Rashid Pasha went south on the steamship the Kalia with the other commanders, reaching Massawa on 14 December 1875. Al-Ayyubi gives a description of an onboard babble. The commander-in-chief of the campaign, Ratib Pasha, was Turkish. Major General William Wing Loring, his chief of staff, was American. The rest of the officers were a mix of Turks, Circassians, Americans, Austrians, and Germans, along with one Italian convert to Islam and a Sudanese. Al-Ayyubi claims that although they had little combat experience themselves, the Turks and Circassians, Ratib Pasha and Rashid Pasha among them, conspired to withhold their cooperation from Loring and frustrate his plans. The resulting confusion led to the overwhelming victory of Ethiopian forces at the Egyptian-held fort at Gura on 7 March 1876. Some 3,273 Egyptians were killed, and 1,416 were wounded, with just 530 escaping the battle unscathed. Rashid Pasha was killed in the fighting. According to Al-Ayubi, as he lay in his own blood, Ethiopian soldiers stripped his body of its finery, dividing the hall among themselves and castrating him before moving off to pursue the rout, meaning that this Rashid was buried, if he was buried at all, in Ethiopia. The dead were buried in the wadi and the stream beds, writes Al-Ayubi. There were almost 2,000 of them, and they were not interred properly, for the rains soon washed the topsoil from their corpses, and the wild beasts fed on their flesh. Reading this, I was secretly hoping that this improbable Rashid would not turn out to be an ayatz. The final Rashid Pasha came from a family with close ties to Muhammad Ali. His name first enters the record in the 1850s, on a list of officials responsible for digging canals, draining marshland, and reclaiming desert land for agriculture. By 1868, he was governor of Cairo. He was among the founders of the Egyptian Geographic Society in 1875, and a year later, he joined what was then called the Privy Council, where he headed the precursor of the Ministry of Finance. From January 1878 to April 1879, he was speaker of the final parliamentary sessions to be held in the reign of Khedive Ismail. There is almost no information about his origins or life outside of these facts, though in 1868, we find him registered as a member of the Society of Knowledge, which places him, in the historian Al-Rafai's words, among the best classes in society. To take the tone of a policier, it looked like this was the Rashid Pasha I wanted. If he turned out to be the owner of the tomb where Inayat lay, I would have to return to his story. But first, I needed to see the tomb for myself. The driver took Salah Salem Street as far as Sayyida Aisha Square, where he turned right, dropping me off a few minutes later at a narrow opening in a wall that ran parallel to the road. "Ask here," he said. "There's 1,000 can show you the way." I stepped through the opening onto a ruler-straight street. To my right, there was a high wall broken by sections of black corrugated iron, and to my left, the entrances to the tombs, each dressed in a fresh coat of yellow. I saw a little girl trotting towards me. She wore a violet robe flounced in tears. Loaves slumped across the lattice of palm fronds that she balanced on her head. The sight was so compelling that I longed to take a picture and wished I had a tourist's audacity. The girl passed me. Then the scrape of her sandals stopped abruptly, and I looked round to find her standing and staring. Our eyes met. Did she know where Al-Afifi was? Man or street? She was older than I thought. I took a couple of steps towards her and asked the way to the nearest bakery. She described it precisely. It wasn't as crowded there as I had anticipated, and I sensed people watching me. A woman asked what I was after, and as we were trying to figure out whether Al-Afifi was a street or an alley, a gentleman seated on the ground, sunning himself and smoking, remarked, "She'll be one of those newspaper people come to take her photos and fuck off." Politely, as though I hadn't heard, I asked him if he knew where I might find the tomb of Rashid Pasha in Al-Afifi. "There are no Afifis here, but there's Abu Aouf's court. I'll take you if you want." Better I find my own way, I thought, but I made a mental note to refer to a court, not a tomb, the next time I asked for directions. If I didn't find an ayat today, she would send me a sign when she was ready. I wandered aimlessly, peering through the entrances to the courts and up at the family names over their lintels. I didn't mean to spy, but every step I took delivered me countless scenes from their interiors. I was in a strange mood. Not frustrated exactly, because Inayat had taught me over the years that nothing about her would ever come easily. Nor did the traduced beauty of these tombs inspire any sense of sorrow in me, or moral judgment on the living occupants who disturbed the rest of the dead. I couldn't remember which of my friends had once described his moods as pins and needles, but it fitted perfectly. Around me, the living were sleeping and waking, eating and bickering and breeding. It was somehow ugly to witness, painful even, a scene better not seen at all. Yet at the same time, it offered powerful evidence of a will to live, of their resolve. Passing by the incised names, bedrooms, kitchens, and washing tubs all open and spilling onto the streets, the electric cable strung tight across Kufic calligraphy, and every soul shall taste death. My initial shock shaded into familiarity. Cactuses next to dried flowers, next to mounds of rubbish, a smell of piss and fried garlic. Barefoot children scampering, one in an Adidas t-shirt, a gas range set on a grave, a washing line slung from tree trunk to marble headstone. Mayada al-Hinawi singing, I adore you. And despite the chill, beneath the tree that fronted the green of a finely worked iron gate, a knot of men all smoking in their underwear, white shorts and vests, and nothing else besides, as though lounging by an invisible seashore. As I went, my mind began to wander with me, a memory of the last time I'd been to the cemetery in Basati. It was back in 1995, not a funeral, but a wedding. Whose, I don't know, but the Sufi praise singer Sheikh Yasin al-Tahami had performed. That night it had seemed the most beautiful place in the world. A summer breeze, the distant lights from the top of Mokattam's cliff face, strangers holding out hands that held fat joints, and the rasp of al-Tahami's voice. What good be there in love if it should spare the heart? I had floated motionless for hours, that extraordinary sensation of being cut off from past and present. Not of going away, exactly. Not of travelling. But rather that you're flying. A flight which ends with the end of the night. The day after my walkabout, I had a taxi drop me off on 16th Street. I passed the shoppers and the sellers, the pavements and the walls of the courts, covered with goods and every conceivable kind of scrap and appliance. VCRs and washing machines and gas bottles, window frames and bedsteads in wood and iron, aluminium cabinets and broken chairs and car tires, empty bottles that once held quality whiskey and vodka. A market for the waste, disgorged from the city's guts. I turned off one side street into another, then another, and I began to hear my own footsteps. There was no one around me, like I'd wandered into the outskirts of the city of the dead. I came to a great tomb, towering like a castle, barred against invaders by huge locks hanging from its gate. Through the railings, I could make out cactuses and well-tended flowers. And I imagined the lucky residents stepping out from their burial chamber bedrooms at dawn to gather in the courtyard and talk. Squabbling children brought me out of my reverie. An Adidas t-shirt again. Surely not the same child I'd seen the day before. Adidas among the tombs, came the thought. And all of a sudden I was remembering a relative of mine. A classmate back in primary school, who'd become a construction worker in Cairo. One of the most intensely pious people I've ever known. Gentle with his family, prays the five prayers daily and goes into seclusion for the last 10 days of Ramadan. He has never harmed a soul, and to me is the model of what a true Muslim should be. I once saw him, dapper and handsome, wearing a t-shirt which bore, in English, the slogan of an abortion rights campaign from overseas. The right to choose. It's my body. God knows where he'd found it. I'd been unsure. Should I tell him? Did he have the right to know? A moral quandary which I settled inside a minute. I didn't say a word. And now I felt guilty. My journey ended at a makeshift cafeteria outside the entrance to a tomb. Seated on one of the red plastic chairs that were clustered beneath an ancient tree, I felt at peace, as though this little stand of chairs had always been my destination, and ordered a tea, then changed my mind, and asked for a bottle of water. "We don't have bottled water, miss. Will you take a Pepsi?" "Please." A man seated beside me smiled my way, and once we had exchanged greetings, I asked him if he knew the area. "Well, I've lived here for 40 years. We chatted for a while, and, emboldened, I lit myself a cigarette and another for him. He wanted to know why I'd come, and I told him that I was looking for a street called Al-Afif. An alley, perhaps. "There's no Al-Afifi here," he said. "It must be in Basatin or the Mamluk Cemetery." "This isn't Basatin?" I must have come further than I thought. I once read that this stretch of desert was where the Mamluks held their military parades. Their rites and races, feats of arms and religious feasts, they chose to be buried here because it is so dry. Amid its miles of walls and doors, the ramrod avenues and evergreen trees, outsiders quickly lose their way. Historical periods tangle, interleaving their walis and pashas, mosques and palaces, the shrines of their saints. There are no signs to mark boundaries in the city of the dead. I intended to resume my search the next day, convinced I must be very close to finding an ayat's grave. But this was naive. I would finally locate Rashid Pasha's tomb in the summer of 2018. Only to learn that this tomb is not the end of the trail. Inayat's resolve, it seemed, was as strong as Paula had claimed, as though she were watching over every moment of my journey and wanted me to reach her by some other road.